Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Take Aim, a production of Accuracy in Media. I'm Mal Klein, substituting for Roger Aronoff, our producer, who's out this week, and we'll be back next. And we've got quite an exciting show for you today. We like to tackle the issues that the media don't and the aspects of them, the key ones that the media miss. And I want to get right to our first caller in a bit because this is a great guest, a fine young man I've had an opportunity to know this year, Ben Lerner. He's got a lot of experience in Homeland Security, and he's working for a group, Center for Security Policy, whose director, Frank Gaffney, was featured on last week's program. Ben has written or co-authored with E.J. Kimball the definitive report I've seen in the private sector, or for that matter, the public one, on Guantanamo Bay, known in shorthand as Gitmo. Now, both presidential candidates came out for closing it last year, and when that happens, it's usually played as bipartisan agreement settled. However, now it's turning out to be quite unsettling. The president passed an executive order ordering it closed by the end of the year, but even his supporters are admitting, hey, it's not as easy as we thought it would be. His favorite think tank, the Center for American Progress, had a big seance over at their headquarters in which they all were hand-wringing on just this very subject. And I want to bring Ben on to talk about exactly what's at stake here. And there's a lot of misconceptions about Gitmo, especially who is guilty and who is innocent. And since the guilty tend to be terrorists, as Ben found, it's important, I think, to get to know more about them. Also, we're bringing on our director, the director of Accuracy in Media, Don Irvine, who's going to lead off the questioning and probably tell you a little bit more about us.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Ben, are you on the line yet?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great.
Welcome, Ben.
Good to be with you,
Ben. Yeah, thanks for coming on the program today. Well, as Mel said, we'll just get kind of right into this. First question here is, how many prisoners are actually, you know, at Gitmo, and, you know, to satisfy my curiosity, how long have they been there on the average?
Well, right now there are 229 detainees left in Guantanamo Bay, which I will also just refer to as Gitmo shorthand. That is down from 780 detainees at the post 9/11 height. So right now we're down to about 229.
How many have been released then? Just to help me with my math here.
Well, I think we're looking at about roughly in the neighborhood of 500 having been released since the facility was open for the purpose of detaining these guys. So it's important to point out that the ones who are left, I think it's fair to say are left because there are serious concerns about releasing them. I mean, after all, 500 of them have already been let go from the facility since its inception.
So out of those that have been released, though, have we been able to identify how many were affiliated with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda?
Well, official Department of Defense reports say that of the 500 detainees that have been moved from Gitmo, 61 have returned to terrorism. Now, there are unofficial sources in the Pentagon who actually place that number at more in the neighborhood of just over 100. And these guys, you know, when they're released and put into foreign custody, I think we've seen what happens. And I'll just give you a handful of examples. You know, in September of 2008, the American embassy in Yemen was attacked, leaving 11 dead. And that attack was carried out by Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Now, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen happens to be a former Guantanamo Bay inmate. And just, you know, a couple more examples to let you know what happens when these guys are turned over to foreign custody. March of this year, 2009, a truck bomb is detonated in Mosul, Iraq, killing 13 and injuring 42. That truck bomb was detonated by a former Gitmo inmate, which Al-Qaeda on its website identified as the Lion of Guantanamo. We'll just keep going with a couple of more here. You know, the Taliban's top operations officer in southern Afghanistan as of March 2009 was a Gitmo detainee. He was released to the Afghan authorities, who in turn released him, and this is what he ended up taking on as his new line of work. And finally, I just want to come to our friends, the Saudis, and I think it's important to talk about them in this context. They have a widely touted rehabilitation program for terrorists, if you will. I guess they color and paint and talk about their feelings, and that's supposedly going to get them away from being terrorists. But in any event, they have a rehabilitation program. 11 Saudis that were handed over from Guantanamo Bay to the Saudi rehabilitation program went through terrorist rehab and then showed up on a list of 85 wanted terrorism suspects in February of 2009. And that was after they went through the Saudi rehab program. So clearly, the track record is not good for releasing these guys from Gitmo into foreign custody, certainly. They're not returning to lead quiet lives. They're returning to the battlefield, which I think it can be expected. After all, we are in the middle of a war.
In a way, you answered my next question, but let me just kind of re-ask it a little bit. Is there a ballpark number? Has anybody tallied exactly how many examples of these released terrorists returning to terrorism there are?
Well, as I mentioned, the Department of Defense has said that roughly 61 of the 500 detainees moved from Guantanamo have returned to terrorism in some form. And that's been documented in other countries as well, like Iraq, Afghanistan, Russia, and a couple of others that don't come to mind at the moment. But again, Human Events reported a few months back, I believe it was in a piece by Rowan Scarborough, that that some unofficial sources in the Pentagon that didn't want to be publicly named actually placed that estimate at more like at about just over 100. So we're if those unofficial estimates are correct, then we're talking about roughly 25% recidivism rate for Gitmo detainees being released and returning to terrorism.
Known so far.
Known so far, exactly.
Okay.
So out of those remaining, do we have a number about how many of those may be with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda affiliates?
Well, that information is kind of tough to come by. I was not able to find an exact breakdown of that. You know, the past administration and the current administration, frankly, are not entirely forthcoming with exactly what that kind of a breakdown is in terms of how many were picked up, in Afghanistan versus Iraq versus operations in Pakistan.
Is that a national security type of concern?
You mean releasing that a breakdown of information?
Right.
I would imagine that it might be. I don't know exactly why they're not releasing that information, but and it may be that it's out there and it's just in a place where it's tough to come by it. But I think in general there is a certain level of secrecy warranted in terms of what happens at Gitmo and exactly who is there. So far this administration has shown an inclination, unfortunately, to take courses of action that are unfortunately detrimental to American national security when it comes to the question of Guantanamo Bay.
Silly question, Ben. So who exactly releases them? Is this a military tribunal that decides they're innocent, not a danger to society, or what?
I think it's a combination of a few different things. I think, the process, frankly, is little bit unclear, and it remains to be seen exactly how the Boumediene case is going to play out. The Boumediene case, for those who don't know, was a Supreme Court case decided last year, a 5-4 decision in which the Supreme Court amazingly said that foreign nationals who are being held as unlawful enemy combatants overseas are actually constitutionally entitled to federal habeas corpus, that is to say, civilian judicial review of their detention. So there are currently mechanisms in place to determine whether an alleged enemy combatant at Gitmo is being held lawfully or unlawfully via combatant status review tribunals or CSERTs, less formal military tribunals put together for that purpose. There are also some individuals that are before, I guess, more formal military commissions. I believe some of the individuals directly implicated in the 9/11 attacks of September 2001 are looking at those more kinds of formal military commissions to determine their fate. But some of this is still very much in flux, particularly after the Boumediene case.
Well, of those that are still incarcerated over there, I mean, do we have an idea of what types of crimes they committed to land there?
Well, you know, if you're there, chances are you were caught up in trying to facilitate acts of terrorism or commit acts of terrorism. I mean, you know, some of the folks who were there include Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the self-confessed and self-described mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, and several of his accomplices, not to mention some individuals who were involved in the USS Cole bombing back in 2000, and several other folks who were implicated in acts of terrorism during the course of hostilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there are allegations by some human rights groups that some of the folks who are in Gitmo were just sort of swept up off of the battlefield and incarcerated there because the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, you know, cut a deal and received some cash in return for turning these guys over to the American authorities, and that they've been languishing there ever since. I haven't seen a lot of evidence to back that up.
By the way, we should point out that Ben's entire report, Ben and EJ's entire report, is available at CenterForSecurityPolicy.org. I got that website right, didn't I?
You sure did. It's also an easier way to identify it might just be SecureFreedom.org.
Okay, great. My next question is, as you show in the report and as you're pretty much showing us here, we actually do have people in Gitmo who are guilty and a danger to society by just about anybody's definition. So you close Gitmo, where do they go?
Well, that's a great question, and the president is frankly struggling with this very question. You know, you guys are probably aware that you know, a major part of the closure process was to include the release of a report by the president's detention policy task force. That report was supposed to come out on the 21st of this month, and it was supposed to detail how to close Gitmo and what to do with these guys. That report's been delayed by 6 months, and it's, you know, really casting serious doubt on whether the president can close this facility by January. But to answer your question, you know, we close it down. You know, some of these guys will be resettled in foreign countries, and as we discussed earlier, we've seen what that tends to result in. To some extent, they may be resettled in some European countries, but it remains unclear exactly what kind of security guarantees they'll be able to give us that these terrorists or these perhaps alleged terrorists would not simply return to the battlefield in some other capacity from Europe. The other option is bringing them here for detention and trial inside the United States, which has a whole separate set of problems. And, you know, it's interesting that Director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, who is FBI director under the previous administration and has been held over into the current administration, just testified for the House Judiciary Committee this year that transferring detainees to the U.S. Would involve tremendous risks to the American public, even if they were to be held in maximum security facilities. And Director Mueller pointed out that these guys would be capable of still providing finances and running terror operations from inside American prison facilities. And also, it's important to point out, because this has been very underexplored, and unfortunately, we were not able to put this in the paper because this report was not released until after our report was released, but the RAND Corporation just put out a report not long ago discussing the radicalization inside prison populations in Europe by Islamist prisoners. And you know, I don't see any reason why that sort of thing could not happen here, where you have Islamic radicalization in the prison systems. And there is evidence that that has already been happening. And the other thing to point out is that, you know, some say, well, you know, there's no issue with Islamic radicalization. There's no issue with these guys being able to run terrorist operations or recruit from inside jails, because we'll just put them in solitary confinement in Supermax and they'll never see anybody ever again. Well, it's worth pointing out two things in response to that. First is that the Denver head of the ACLU, when asked whether putting these guys in Supermax would be sufficient in his view, responded, and I'm paraphrasing him here, but he responded that putting these guys in solitary confinement in Supermax would just be another form of torture. Okay. Now, the other thing to point out is that Richard Reed, who you guys may recall as the shoe bomber who thankfully was thwarted in his attempt to blow up a airliner over the ocean by lighting a shoe on fire, he was in solitary confinement in Supermax prison. He had special restrictions placed on him by the federal government because he was considered a very dangerous prisoner because of his terrorist history. Well, recently, those special restrictions were lifted because Mr. Reed went on a hunger strike. And the federal authorities decided that in response to, I guess he went a couple of weeks without food and they had to forcibly feed him and rehydrate him, that they would lift his restrictions. So now he, he was saying that the federal authorities were preventing him from practicing Islam. So now he's allowed to pray with the other prisoners. He's allowed to have all sorts of practices. He's allowed to undergo all sorts of religious practices that were denied to him previously. So the point being that once these guys get into an American prison facility, it starts to open up all sorts of other issues that unfortunately will trend in the direction of giving these guys greater legal protections and greater freedom within the prison system. So there are serious risks associated with bringing these guys here, both in terms of American public safety and in terms of the risk, frankly, that these guys could be let go outright. You know, if they're put in a civilian trial, a lot of these guys were captured on the battlefield, and it's not as if there was a CSI crime lab on the premises. You know, so a lot of the evidence that's being brought against these guys is being brought against them due to classified information. So if we bring these guys into a civilian courtroom where judges tend to try to frame things so that the defendants get the maximum protection that they can from our system, it puts the federal government in a very awkward position. They either have to divulge classified information in order to make their case against some of these guys, or alternatively, just simply let them go. And that's a very real risk. And so there are all sorts of problems associated with bringing these guys into the United States, and which makes closing Guantanamo Bay a real public safety and national security problem.
Well, you know, just to follow up with that just for a bit, too, it just seems that, you know, once the politicians seem to realize some of these risks, they also didn't seem to be too keen on having them, maybe located in their states either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there has been tremendous pushback, and I might add from both sides of the aisle, to bringing these guys into the United States or at least bringing them into their respective states. And Congress has already denied funding to the president. He had previously requested, I believe it was something on the order of $80 million to close Gitmo and do whatever it is he plans to do with these guys. That funding was denied by both parties, citing a lack of a plan. As far as I can tell, there's no money forthcoming for that purpose until the president can actually come up with a plan that addresses these concerns.
I mean, do we even have space for all these people anyway, legitimately?
Well, it's not really clear if we have space. I've seen conflicting reports saying that a place like Supermax is just at capacity right now. But there have been some sources that have told me that in recent days that roughly 25 beds have been cleared. Clearly people have their eye on Supermax as a potential destination for these folks. But there are plenty of members of Congress from Colorado or from Kansas, where Fort Leavenworth is, who just don't want these guys in their state. And part of that, I suspect, is due to the security risks that they pose. I mean, keep in mind also that once these guys are transferred into a civilian prison or a military brig in a state for that matter, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that their sympathizers would see a tremendous martyrdom opportunity in trying to free these guys or trying to just inflict massive pain on the civilian population nearby, or at least the closest civilian population to the facility, to make a point to the rest of the world. And I think that risk grows when you put these guys inside the United States.
By the way, Senator Inhofe has pointed out that our total rent at Gitmo for 100 years was $4,000. What is the cost of moving these folks here to the U.S.?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, as I mentioned, the president had requested $80 million, and that was denied. The Department of Defense had previously, according to the Associated Press, requested $50 million for the purpose of creating building from scratch inside the United States what effectively would have been a second Gitmo. It's amazing that they keep asking for this money to build facilities that are already running very well down in Cuba under American control. As far as if we were to transfer these guys over here, in addition to having to construct extra wings or just construct facilities from scratch that could address all of the security concerns, we would also have to pay for their food and probably their attorneys. And if they were let go and they couldn't be repatriated anywhere else in the world, because there are many countries who would not want to take these guys, and there are many countries who we could not legally give them to because we are obligated not to resettle anyone in a country where they have a reasonable fear of torture or persecution, which is why we could not send the Uyghurs back to China, incidentally. If they are stuck here in the United States, we would probably have to pay for some of their resettlement costs here in the U.S., and that was what National Intelligence Director Dennis Blair had said, I believe it was last year.
Okay, I guess it's your turn, Don.
No, go ahead and do that. I'm going to switch phones here because they said it was too staticky.
Oh, okay. Okay. Here's a question. The only thing I've seen of this is allegations, you know, from the lawyers bringing suit on behalf of one prisoner or another and making some assertion and the Koran flushing stories of a few years back. But just what hard verifiable evidence is there that prisoners were abused at Gitmo?
To be honest with you, Mal, I was actually just reading the Washington Post this morning from a previous issue of the Washington Post, previous edition. And I recall someone from, it might have been the Department of Defense or Department of Justice, indicating that there was really only one documented case of treatment of a Gitmo detainee by American forces that rose to the level of torture.
One?
So it's it's amazing, but these allegations persist, and it gives you a window into what would happen if these guys were to be transferred into the United States. Because once we transfer them into the U.S., it doesn't stop there. A lot of these human rights organizations, a lot of these defense lawyers, and those who are funding them, frankly, want these guys released outright. And so they will keep alleging that these guys are being tortured, that they're being abused inside prisons in the United States. So we're not going to hear the end of this once we transfer these guys into the United States. It's a very slippery slope once we take them out of Gitmo.
Well, I think we're just about out of time for this segment, but let me ask you this in terms of something we're always interested in. I mean, what is your take about how the media has covered this entire issue?
Well, I think that the media has frankly really done a disservice to the United States by failing to point out how much the previous president, President Bush, did to protect the United States from another terrorist attack and the wisdom of putting these folks in a facility that kept us safe. It's very easy for then Senator Obama to criticize the existence of Gitmo from the campaign trail. But I think now that he's in the White House and he's finding how complicated this issue really is and how there really are bad guys there, and they're not just all hapless victims of circumstance, I think he's learning the hard way that that this is really easier said than done, and that he really needs to be more considerate of American public safety than European public opinion. And unfortunately, what we've seen is a tremendous deference to the latter at the expense of the former. And as far as media coverage of that, I think the media has not done such a terrific job of explaining why these guys needed to be put in Gitmo in the first place. And it's easy to get away from those things 8 years after September 11th, but God forbid if there's another catastrophic terrorist attack in the United States, people are going to want to know what this president has in mind to keep us safer. And right now, public opinion polling is very much against bringing terrorist detainees into the United States. And I think the media has largely failed to explore that further as well.
Ben, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you so much for doing this report. Folks, you got to check it out at centerforsecuritypolicy.org or securefreedom.org. And thanks again, Ben.
Good to be with you guys. Thank you.
Great. Don, you there?
I am here. Our next guest, is he called in yet?
Our next guest is not on yet. So, just to want to point out one thing, if I might, if I have a minute or two, and that is that I believe. Oh.
Hello?
I think our next guest is here.
Yeah, I called a little while ago. Hello? Somebody there?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
hi, this
here.
Is Bob Knight.
How are you, sir? He's just written a wonderful book called Fighting for America's Soul, How Sweeping Changes Threaten Our Nation and What We Must Do. And it's chock full of interesting perspectives and insights and many wonderful pieces of information put out by Coral Ridge Ministries, where our guest works. Don, you want to take it from here?
Sure, sure. Bob, it's good to talk with you today. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Don.
All right. You note in the that the Hippocratic Oath, as amended by a physician from Tufts, became abortion-friendly in 1964. Is that when the push to make abortion on demand the law of the land really began?
Well, it probably began long before that with the founding of Planned Parenthood, which began as a birth control organization in the 1920s, but morphed into the nation's biggest proponent of abortion and now biggest provider of abortion. But in terms of legal changes and even within the medical profession, yeah, the 60s unleashed a lot of unfortunate consequences, and one of them was the drive to legalize abortion, which came about Roe v. Wade, 1973.
Bob, I have to ask, on page 27, you quote a British anthropologist, this really jumped off the page at me, who said in 1935, "I do not know of a case on which great energy has been displayed by a society that has not been absolutely monogamous." Is there indeed a link between traditional morality and a productive society?
Oh, I believe so. And that you're quoting J.D. Unwin, the British anthropologist who wrote that back in the 30s. And he was no conservative. He was a liberal. But he looked around societies on every continent and found that those that did not honor monogamy, strict monogamy, as he put it, which is man-woman marriage, soon fell into disarray, and eventually it led to revolution. And he looked at Chinese dynasties. He looked at African societies. He said it was across the board. It was a monogamy allows people to generate creative energy and channel it into constructive ways. When sex gets outside a monogamous relationship, basically all hell breaks loose. And, of course, we've seen that in America with the advent of the sexual revolution, with the rise in divorce and abortion and sexually transmitted diseases. It's not a pretty sight. And if we don't turn it around, we're risking the fate of other societies that ended up on the dustbin of history.
Well, conversely, we just had a pro-life president who gave Planned Parenthood more federal money than they ever got in their history because of his love of the growth extended to federal programs. Isn't it possible that less government really is the best way to protect traditional values?
I agree with you, Don. In fact, that was the founding vision of the people who started this country, was that, I point this out in the book, that what we have right now is a clash of worldviews. You have the Judeo-Christian worldview, which is that we're created in the image of God, where each life is of inestimable value, and therefore government has a responsibility to protect life, and also that we're fallen creatures, we're prone to sin, and so therefore no man or group of men should have ultimate power over his fellow man. And this was at the heart of our America's founding. That's all being challenged now by this drive to replace that vision with a secular collectivism in which government is God, government controls everything we do. And the best evidence of that, I think, and I have a chapter on it in my book, is on the government takeover of healthcare. This Obamacare is a very frightening prospect, and I think it will be the rock upon which the good ship Obama founders. That's my hopeful prediction, because people are finding out how radical this is. Everything from millions of Americans losing their current health care, despite the president's promises that we'll keep our plans if we like them, to forced counseling for all seniors every 5 years to discuss end-of-life issues. You know, can you imagine a cost-conscious bureaucrat bringing your grandmother in and saying, you know, you've had a lot of expensive care, but we think we can use that money to better use, so I'm sorry, you're not going to have that procedure. That's what we're talking about.
Well, let me step in here one more time about this too and follow up, since you hit upon health care. I assume you watched the press conference last night?
I didn't. I didn't. Actually, I had something better to do, a Bible study.
Well, that was probably a better use of your time than listening to that. But have you followed up by reading about it or seeing this?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
The president. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what's your take based on what you've seen or read about the press conference and his defense of his Obamacare as such?
Well, I think he went into his best wonkish mode and tried to use too much detail to explain it to Americans, and at the same time oversimplified it at times. I've heard much about the blue pill, red pill analogy that, you know, if you have a blue pill and a red pill and they do the same thing, then one's more expensive, then you take just the one, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, does he think the nation's a bunch of morons? I mean, surely the word has leaked out about how radical this healthcare takeover is and how it will lead to a single-payer, government-controlled system, which will lead to rationing of care. I think he's fighting a losing battle. I think the word is out. The conservative Democrats are now at war with him. And in the typical ham-handed way, the Democratic National Committee is running ads in the districts of Ways and Means Committee Democrats who just ask questions about Obamacare. I mean, they have a very bullying, thug-like approach to putting their policies through. But they're being found out.
Speaking of bullying approach, question. Books and movies 40 years ago portrayed homosexuality as a sickness requiring treatment. Now it's treated as a civil right. How did that change come about?
Well, it began, I believe, with the studies of Alfred Kinsey, the sex research pioneer who produced Sexual Behavior in the Human Male in 1948 and a companion female volume in 1953. And these books are about 2 inches thick, loaded with charts. They look very scientific. And they're a pile of fraud and deceit. I could go into the whole Kinsey thing, but he's been unmasked as a fraud and as a very promiscuous homosexual himself. But nonetheless, the media took this as proof that America was awash in bizarre sexual experimentation, that there is really no normal, that many women were having abortions that weren't at the time. And this fueled the drive to legalize and promote pornography. Playboy magazine led the charge, citing Kinsey and the Playboy philosophy. And as the lid came off, homosexual activists took advantage and said, well, look, if anything goes, then what we're doing is not wrong. But it really annoys us if people still think it might be wrong, so we're going to try to put a set of laws into place that say that traditional morality is a form of bigotry punishable by law. And we're going to begin with corporations. They invaded the educational system. The psychiatric and psychological guilds, the APAs, got them to change their views on it, all without any scientific backing at all, promoted a series of false studies, such as genetic studies showing you're born that way. They have not been replicated. They've been refuted, and even the APA has changed its view that there's any real evidence that people are born that way and can't change. But from gay parenting studies to the 10% estimate, which people know is bogus now, it's more like 1% or 2%, I mean, they have propounded a series of lies through the mainstream media, which has adopted them as its civil rights cause, and fooled a lot of Americans into thinking they're poor victims. And, you know, your heart goes out to people who are subject to homosexual desires, but what they need is hope for change, not being told there is no hope and they better go ahead and engage in that behavior. The consequences are enormous, from breakdown of families to sexually transmitted diseases. I mean, I could go on and on. It's not compassionate to promote that stuff, and yet we have it being promoted now right out of the White House.
Well, I want to go back. I just was checking. I just got an email here that Congressman Pence is sponsoring an amendment to, in essence, to defund Planned Parenthood. And he said on this that apparently, I guess, 16 Democrats had signed on to something similar in 2007. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but can you give me any feedback or comment about what you think about that amendment, or whether or not, you know, he has any remote chance of getting more signers and any kind of success?
Well, there are a lot of people in Congress who say they're pro-life, so I think he'll get a lot of sponsors. Given the liberal leadership of Congress, with Nancy Pelosi heading the House and Harry Reid in the Senate, both of them not of any help on this, but on the other side of the fence, I don't see much hope of it actually getting enacted. But you have to do these kinds of things. The left has done it for years. They've put forth proposals that they knew didn't have a snowflake's chance of getting passed, only to build up momentum for the day when they did have a majority. And that's what we're seeing now. They're trying to ram through a number of radical proposals. I'm just sorry the Republicans, when they had control of Congress, didn't do it when they had the chance. They had the majorities. But that's because a lot of Republicans are not pro-life. They are pro-abortion. And so they may not have gotten it through even with a Republican administration. But I do salute Representative Pence for raising the flag and going for it.
All right, I'm going to change this a little bit. Left-wing radical movements of the 1960s and the sexual revolution are usually treated separately by historians and journalists. Should they be?
They should be, well, when you say separately, they get favorable treatment because largely the media are secular and leftist. And I point out in my book that this left-wing assault on the family and sexual morality didn't begin in the 60s. It really began with the socialist philosophers in the 1800s because they recognized that the family was the greatest challenge to them creating the idea that an individual should be beholden only to the state. And they saw families and religion as their natural enemies. Marx and Engels were very clear about it. And I quote Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's co-author, in the Family versus the State chapter, to show the mentality that has taken hold of our government today. The more you expand government to replace family functions, the more trouble you cause, the more dysfunction you create, and the more need for more government to pick up the pieces. It really took off with the welfare system of the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson, which destroyed the inner city families, and continued on through the sexual revolution. It's profoundly destructive, and it's good for people to know how it came about, why they're pursuing it. There's a real reason behind it, and it's hostility to God and God's transcendent moral values.
Speaking of which, the growth of government and the disappearing American family are usually treated as separate stories also, separate magazine covers. To what degree did one lead to the other, if you could pursue that just a bit further?
Well, this is a topic I like to bring up with my libertarian friends who are always talking about limited government and how we have to cut down the size of the state. And then they go along with the left on all the destructive policies that are destroying families, which are the one thing that creates self-governing individuals who are productive and don't need more government and actually oppose it. So on the one hand, they're saying, gee, we got to have less government. On the other hand, they're feeding the destructive policies that have led to major expansion of government at all levels. If you look at the trillions of dollars spent picking up the pieces of broken families, that's where the real growth in government has come. you know, apart from defense spending, since we're the world's only superpower and we do have a huge defense budget and we need it. We have a lot of enemies out there. But in terms of government growth, you can trace most of it back to the decline of the family and its replacement by the state.
Well, as you show in the book, at the same time that government programs have increased so that politicians can show that they care about the poor, the federal government has been reining in private charities. Was this an unintended or an intended consequence?
I believe it's an intended consequence. That's a great question, Don. In the chapter, The War on Private Charity, I point out that the president has successfully rammed through a $5 billion increase in the next 5 years for AmeriCorps and $10 billion over the next 10 years. And here's what's behind it. If you, on the one hand, promote secular charities and you send government all this government money only to charities that promise not to proselytize, in other words, not to any church-run charities which would share the gospel, then you're competing with church-run charities and you're squeezing them out of the market. You're saying, hey, why volunteer for your church when the government will actually pay you to do similar work? At the same time, the Obama administration has proposed cutting charitable deductions for the wealthiest donors. And everybody in a 501c3 knows that all of these organizations are supported by lots of donors, but you have to turn to your biggest donors often to make up deficits. This would kill that. Marvin Feldstein, who was an economic advisor to President Bush, wrote a column and said that for every dollar that they cut in deductions for charities, they're going to lose at least that many. If you punish people for deducting for charities, charities are going to lose a commensurate number of dollars. So it could be hundreds of millions of dollars that charities lose. That's the double squeeze. Think of a big vice squeezing private charity out, and that's the apparently the intent of the Obama administration and many in Congress.
Hey, you point out that politicians in Washington are now trying to push this idea of mandatory civilian service. Great Britain has had this for years. Hasn't it been something of an expensive joke over there?
I'm not sure how it's worked out in Britain, but I can't imagine a free nation like the United States mandating it. You know, Israel might make a case for it because they're surrounded by enemies, and so everybody has to be a de facto part of the National Guard. Even women are trained, even though they're not put in combat. But in terms of national service, it's a way to make the state more important than religion. It redirects human activity away from families and churches toward the government. So I think it's profoundly immoral, actually. And I know some conservatives actually favor it. They think it will inspire patriotism and build community and so forth. I don't think so. I'd rather go back to our founding fathers' vision that the less government is better.
Your book mostly focuses on policies of the Obama administration, and we've seen what's going on there, but weren't some of these policies and things put in place by President Bush?
Well, President Bush started the stimulus package. I mean, he is culpable, I think, for not reining in massive federal spending. It's one of the reasons the Republicans were thrown out of power. They were not disciplined. They got drunk with power, and they let a lot of their pork projects go through. They started acting like Democrats, spending like drunken sailors, as Ronald Reagan would say. And I believe that cost them power. Now, to Bush's credit, he did fight the war on terror. He took whatever steps he needed to keep America safe, which explains why we haven't suffered another 9/11 in many years. But he really did set the tone for many of the policies that Obama's pursuing in much more radical mode. Some people are calling this the Bush-Obama term, but I think that's a little unkind to George Bush. He had his faults, he had his good points, but Obama is taking it to a whole new level. He's making government into God. And by the way, the reason I wrote this book, Fighting for America's Soul, is because we've been hit with so many things in such a short time that I thought I needed to connect the dots for people to show that they all make sense from a certain perspective. They're all geared toward turning America radically from a Judeo-Christian nation into a socialist, godless, secular nation dependent on government. And so once they understand that, they can better resist this whole effort. And that the last chapter is about the growing resistance and what people can do.
Well, let me ask you this then as a follow-up. Do you think the Republicans learned their lesson, you know, after these election losses, and that, you know, should they be able to regain power, will they be able to kind of put us back on the right path?
Well, I think there is emerging leadership, people like Mike Pence and James Inhofe, Jim DeMint. I mean, they're finding their voices. I still think that that the Republicans as a whole are not doing the job in alerting the nation to how radical these changes are and how dangerous they are. They're still approaching them as policy choices. They're crunching them. They got to get off the wonkish mode and start yelling from the rooftops that we need to defeat this tyranny that's enveloping us. They need to sound more like Rush Limbaugh, frankly, who is calling a spade and saying the Nancy Pelosi's of the world really want ultimate power over every aspect of our lives. They're doing it through radical environmental legislation, through a health care takeover, through takeovers of the banks and auto companies. I mean, it's astounding what they're trying to do. And the politicians at the top of the White House and Congress, if you look at where the leaders are from, you know, you got Henry Waxman from West Hollywood, California, which is a homosexual enclave. You got Nancy Pelosi from San Francisco, another very liberal jurisdiction. You got Barney Frank from Massachusetts, which is sends very odd politicians to Washington. Ted Kennedy, the leadership now in charge is from very insulated radical areas and does not represent the U.S. as a whole. And when the U.S. is, I think, wakes up to the fact that a radical group is in charge of policy, I think you'll see far more resistance than you have up till now. And I believe health care is the single thing that will reveal how radical Obama is and will be his undoing.
By the way, speaking of which, you have a chapter showing us, I learned a lot from it, some of the lesser-known appointees in the Obama administration, and this was just priceless to me. David Ogden, Obama's deputy attorney general, once got the Library of Congress to print Playboy in Braille.
Yeah, he did, and that was one of his many successes. He also was a litigator for hardcore pornography companies. I think the most shocking thing he did, though, was to submit a brief in the Knox child pornography case that embarrassed Janet Reno back during the Clinton administration.
Wow.
He had a child pornographer who was taking shots of little kids in a play area, unbeknownst to their parents, doing close-ups of their private areas. He was convicted of child pornography. He appealed his conviction, and when it came up, the Justice Department under Reno refused to defend the conviction. And David Ogden submitted a brief saying, yeah, you know, this guy shouldn't be convicted for child pornography. This was so shocking that Congress nearly unanimously voted a resolution to condemn the Janet Reno and the Justice Department, both houses of Congress, all Democrats and Republicans. And yet here's Obama appointing David Ogden to be Deputy Attorney General of the United States, right at the top of the legal leadership. I mean, and then, you know, this chapter on the radical appointees goes on and on with the bona fides of these people. Americans need to know who's in charge, especially at justice.
Well, that just kind of reminds me of something else I wanted to ask you, which is Obama's had some interesting relations with the homosexuals, the gay movement. It seems that he tries to kind of kowtow to them and yet backs off on certain things, and they don't seem to be very happy with him, and I think they were expecting more. Also, since we're just about probably out of time, too, if you could also give me kind of a quick overview of how you see the media, you know, and their coverage of the Obama administration maybe to date and what you might see in the future.
Okay, to your first question, Don, the Obama administration has moved farther, faster on the homosexual agenda than any other administration, up to and including the Clinton years. Obama has included gender identity, which is transsexuality, transgenderism. He's embraced all of that. He's rammed through this hate crimes bill, which is not law yet, but it's very dangerous. It's this, one of the centerpieces of the homosexual political agenda. He's talked about getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military to homosexualize the military. Homosexual activists always complain they're not getting enough attention. They know it's a good device that makes them look like victims. If you give them 99% of their agenda, they will say, oh, look at that 1%. What have you done for us lately? It's a great tactic. I got to hand it to them. They're relentless, and they know it works. They're never satisfied. But as far as the media, they're a fully owned subsidiary of the gay rights movement and the rest of the left. I've never seen so much bias, Don, and I know you track it daily at Accuracy in Media, and you're appalled as well. I was in journalism for 15 years at the LA Times and other papers, and I've never seen anything like this worship of the left-wing agenda and Obama in particular. I think they've lost all credibility. When ABC News aired from the White House, Obama's health care pitch, and turned over all their news programs to push that pitch, then the jig was up. They were revealing that they were no longer a news reporting outfit, but just an appendage of the Obama administration.
Mal?
You guys still there?
Indeed. Yeah, I am.
Okay.
You point out that another associate attorney general represented Michael Schiavo when he went to court to starve his wife to death?
Yeah, he was the attorney for Michael Schiavo, and he has been appointed assistant attorney general. I believe that's Thomas Pirelli. And then you have several other Justice Department appointees with very radical records. You've got the former head of the Harvard Law School who had, as Solicitor General Kagan, she tried to kick ROTC off campus at Harvard because they won't have homosexuality in the military. I mean, now she's Solicitor General of the United States. One thing I don't cover in the book is Sonia Sotomayor. I believe that her appointment came after the book was published in June, so I don't address her. I do address several other appointees, too. And let's not forget Kathleen Sebelius, who heads Health and Human Services, one of the most pro-abortion governors in history over in Kansas. She has just come out with something shocking. She wants a nationwide assessment of gender identity of kids in public schools. Not sex, but gender, which is, as the feminists say, a social construct.
God. Bob, thank you so much for being with us. And you got to check out this book, Fighting for America's Soul, How Sweeping Change Threatens Our Nation and What We Must Do. And thank you all for joining us and listening to us on Take Aim. Please join us next week as we continue to cover that, which nobody else will. Thank you again.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Bob.
Enjoyed it. You asked great questions.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.